Charm of Favor, Chapter 23.
James nearly dropped the dry erase marker when the knock came at the door and it began to open. The smell of hot food came in with three rolling carts covered in white linen pushed by three people in chef's attire. "Dinner is served, my good people," said the tall Hispanic man with the first cart. "I would start with dessert if I were you," said the young lady, pushing the second cart, stacked with two pies, small bowls, and spoons next to a large silver cooler. "Great! I'm starved," said the admiral. "How can you eat? We just had lunch like 5 minutes ago, and we're so close to having this thing narrowed down," asked James. "Don't listen to him. I was watching the clock myself. I only ate half that Reuben for lunch," said Herbert. "It's not buffet style. We will be happy to serve you. My associate, Lacey, will explain the menu," said the Hispanic man, opening his hand toward the third girl with the last cart. "Since we already know there are no vegans among you, we have two choices of entrees for you. We have Cornish game hens cooked in white wine with our signature rice pilaf base. We have prime rib cooked to perfection and served with boiled potatoes and candied carrots and horseradish on the side. We also have, for dessert, New York's finest cheesecake made right here at Trump Tower, or apple pie a la mode with a cinnamon glaze poured on the ice cream," said the girl. "I could learn to like this government gig," said Herbert. "Need I remind you that we only think we have the what figured out? We need the where," said James, forcing the cap back onto the dry erase marker and rolling up the sleeves on his starched shirt. "Yeah, well, God only help us if the win is during this meal, because I, for one, am off the clock," said Peter. "I am never off the clock," said Hannah. "That's what I'm talking about," said Herbert. "Besides, it will be Trump's fault if the answer is an hour late, right?" asked Hannah. "Maybe he knows from experience wrong answers are more likely to come from people who are not well fed," said Herbert. "We are trained to go days without eating and without sleep," said the admiral. "Oh, and that's worked out really well. How many guided missile destroyers have been T-boned by freighters in the last few years?" asked Hannah. "Well, there you have it. A little Cornish game hen and white wine sauce and apple pie might just save the world. Yes, give me one of those, and just put the ice cream on the side. Yes, right there. Thank you so much," said Herbert, taking the two plates and silverware rolled in a linen napkin back to his plush office chair at the conference table. "Prime rib for me, and I'll have the cheesecake." "Awesome. Thanks," said James. "Does that come with a discount coupon for a rib spreader?" asked Yuri, and they all laughed. "Thank you all for coming to Trump Tower. We will leave this cart for your dishes. When you're finished, just push it outside the door, and we'll take care of the rest. Bon appetit," said the Hispanic chef, as he bowed slightly to the group and swirled his finger around his hat. With that, the two girls pushed their carts for the door. "I guess that means there won't be seconds," asked Herbert. Again, the group laughed, and the sound of silverware touching china eased their minds for a few minutes. "Okay, if I have this right, you guys have narrowed this down to somewhere in the Mid-South for this possible EMP device to go off," said James around a bite of prime rib. "You must come from a big family talking with your mouth full," said Yuri. "Not the Mid-South, the Midwest," said Peter. "What's the difference?" asked James, taking a drink from the sparkling water in his glass. "According to the NERC, the epicenter of the population of the United States is just east of Louisville, Kentucky. That is the Midwest, my friends," said Peter. "So what? It's flyover country. You got, like, what, 100 voters who live there? Why not New York or L.A.?" asked Hannah. "So maybe that's the point. Don't kill 10 million people in New York. Kill 100,000 people in Frankfurt and turn the lights out all the way to Boston," said Peter. "No shit. Boston?" asked Hannah. "Look, we have blown up nearly 3,000 of these things. Lots of them at sea level, and some even in space," said the admiral. Starfish Prime, said Yuri. Exactly, said the Admiral. Sounds like a late-night science fiction movie, said James. July, 1962. A little 1.4 megaton bomb detonated at 240 miles up, knocked out 6 satellites and the electrical system of Hawaii 800 miles away. It even cut a hole in the Van Allen radiation belts for a few hours. A little bigger hole during a solar storm, and we're talking a quasi-extinction-level event here, said the Admiral. Courtesy of the United States military and their infinite wisdom, said Hannah. Hey, if we didn't do it, they would have, said the Admiral. Oh, that is so much transhumanist bullshit, said Hannah. Okay, okay. So, Peter, let's say you're right about the Midwest. Can we narrow that down a little? Asked James. Maybe I should remind you that when it comes to this group, this syndicate, money is no object. If they really want to stop Trump from saving this country, hell, you might as well say the world, they could buy a war quite easily. This thing could be flown over that part of the country and detonated in a chartered 747 at 40,000 feet, said Herbert. They don't check cargo at airports pretty closely? Asked James. A device that size, with decent shielding, would still weigh 500 or 600 pounds, said the Admiral. I thought this was like a suitcase nuke. Who can carry a nuke weighing that much? Asked Yuri. That's a figure of speech. Even a W-88 warhead weighs 800 pounds, and a missile can carry 8 of them at a time. We made a handful of W-91s that weigh around 300 pounds, but no one even knows where those things are. Besides, they have probably been decommissioned by now, said the Admiral. Even if the North Koreans shrunk it by half, it would still take 5 guys to pick it up, said Yuri. Okay, so we're talking about something weighing between 500 and 800 pounds, said James. Look, we don't know if they figured out a way to really make this thing smaller, or whether they just simply designed it to be a better EMP weapon. I mean, I hate to complicate things, but what if this doesn't even look like a bomb? It could look like anything. It could look like a vending machine, right? Asked Hannah. Oh, God, there we go again, into la-la land, said the Admiral. Hey, why don't you go play with your bathtub toys, said Hannah. She's right. But what if this guy doesn't care what it looks like? Because it's in a panel van or a shipping container, asked James. The room was silent for a minute as their minds raced through what seemed like an endless permutation of possibilities. I think we're getting lost in the weeds here. Let's just assume we don't know what this thing is going to look like. It doesn't matter. We have a pretty good idea what it can do. That's the important thing. I think we were brought together to figure out where to shine the spotlight on this guy, you know? Asked James, standing up and twisting the cap off the dry erase marker. I don't even know if it is a guy, or if this person is working alone. Anyway, it won't matter what it looks like when it goes off, said Hannah. I just keep going back to programming. We look at inputs and the outputs. We make logical predictions on the part and in between, said Yuri. Why don't you come up here and show us what you mean? I've been looking at this Gantt chart for hours, and it seems like it's in the right order, but we're not getting anywhere, said James, offering him the marker. Okay, here's the deal, said Yuri, taking the dry erase marker. If we look at this like a program, we have the inputs over here, which are, according to our expert over there, hydrogen to make tritium. Then we have some kind of exotic metal and machine shops. And we have a North Korean motherboard, and we have plutonium, and let's not forget the bomb builder himself. That's an input, said Yuri. Well, that narrows it down to everywhere except Fairbanks, Alaska, said Hannah. Then we have the outputs. Assume an optimum EMP application needs to be somewhere in this area, said Yuri, drawing a circle on the road map around Louisville, Kentucky. Make that bigger, like all the way to Boston, said Peter. Nope, Boston is too far from there. We have to move the center over by about 100 miles, said Yuri. Why? Asked James. Hang on a second. You said something back there. What's an exotic metal? Asked Herbert. Yes, I did, said Yuri. Enlighten me. I'm an accountant. If there's something exotic, it leaves an exotic paper trail, said Herbert. Well, I know radar systems and energy transfer. I don't think you're going to build a uniform compression chamber out of old car parts. You have to have solid, custom-machined chambers that will contain the blast and compress the nuclear pile, said Yuri. So, what are we looking for here? Is this rare? Asked Herbert. Yes, it is. You can't just buy a big chunk of high-grade metal. It has to be ordered, said Yuri. There have to be a limited number of suppliers for that. Now we have an accounting trail, said Herbert. Okay, I'll add that to the input side of our logic problem. Here, said Yuri. Well, look, we're assuming this is in a van, right? Not an airplane. So the pulse can only go about 600 miles or so. The Starfish Prime test was a bigger bomb, and it was located 240 miles up in space. So let's say it's about 0.707 as effective, said Peter. Why? Where'd you get that number? Asked James. Root mean squared. The energy will expand equally in all directions, but its effectiveness will drop off by the square of the distance. This comes out to about 0.707 of the full wave, just like the power coming out of the wall socket. We say it's 120 volts, but actually the full wave is 169 volts. We just can't use it because of the physics of effective energy, said Peter, making a sine wave with his hand to illustrate. So the circle is smaller? Asked James. It's a sphere, but yes. Do we still want to include Boston? Asked Yuri. Not necessarily. I was just saying that because of what was said earlier, said James. I just said the epicenter of U.S. population is just east of Louisville. It could be a little south, said Peter. That would make it Bowling Green or even Nashville, said James. Or Knoxville. That's where Oak Ridge National Lab is. How easy would it be to hide a device in that town, said Hannah. I get the whole Manhattan Project thing, but that doesn't make the plan very effective. Too far east, the Appalachian Mountains might block the pulse. Look, Tennessee borders 7 states. All these freeways connect here and here. If you draw a circle of, say, 500 miles, you get everything from Detroit to Daytona and all the way to New York. That's like 80% of the power grid, nuclear, coal, and hydroelectric. The whole Ohio River Valley and the Upper Cumberland from right there, said Peter, pointing at Nashville. Sweet Jesus. He's right. But what if this guy is expecting that we would see the same thing? Asked James. And you think I'm crazy for wanting to be at sea when this happens? Asked the Admiral. What? You don't want to be in the middle of 150 million hungry, pissed-off people who haven't had a shower in a month? Asked Hannah. Are we settled, then? We tell them an EMP weapon in Nashville, said James, trying to get a consensus. I'd say it's unanimous, wouldn't you? Asked the Admiral. That's still 1.5 million people. I don't know how they're going to stop it, said Peter. I'm making the call, said James. Ross here, said the man answering the phone. You're sure? I understand. Stay where you are. He thumbed the small screen and put it back to his ear. This is Ross. They're ready. Yes, sir. Within a few minutes, he knocked on the conference room door. James opened the door and let him in. Smells great, he said, smiling to the group. You missed supper. Not even dessert left, said James. Gentlemen, ma'am, I need you to get your things together. Your personal vaults are in the lobby, and then I need you to come with me. No phone calls. Keep your phones in the Ziploc bags. Am I clear? Asked Ross. Bathroom break? Asked James. Of course. We must move quickly. Let's go, said Ross. The group walked down the hall to the restrooms and washed up, put their jackets on, and met in the lobby within a few minutes and retrieved their personal items from the vault boxes. Okay, we're ready. Please follow me. And he pushed the elevator button. Again, the elevator agent smiled as the eight of them joined him in the elevator. Roof, please, said Ross. The helicopter engine was already winding up when they reached the roof of Trump Tower. There was a uniformed Marine waiting at the base of the stairs, and they made a single file walking between the yellow-painted lines. By the time they got their seats and fastened their belts, the craft was already rumbling, and the Marine drew up the stairs. Ross snapped a quick salute to the Marine's face in the helicopter window and turned to go back to the building. "Is this Marine One?" asked James to the Marine from the front seat of the passenger cabin. "No, sir, it is not," said the Marine. He looked to be around 30 years old, large and solid in his desert fatigues. "It's my first time on a helicopter," said James, a little louder with the increasing engine sound, wondering why he was trying to smile. "There's a bag in the rack by your seat," said the Marine, pointing to the area below James's window. "Oh, that's okay. I don't get airsick. It's just my first time. Do you know where we're going?" asked James, raising his voice again to overcome the turbine ramping up for liftoff. "Yes, sir," said the Marine, leaning back in his seat and removing his hat. He looked down the aisle to make sure everyone was secure and gently closed his eyes as the craft lifted off the pad and surged forward. James fastened his belt and pulled it snug. "Welcome to Earth," he whispered without facing the Marine. He felt his dinner shift in his stomach as he looked out his window. The helicopter cleared the railing surrounding the roof of Trump Tower and leaned forward to accelerate. Normally, buildings in Manhattan are not allowed to have helicopters land on their roofs anymore, but this building was different now. Everything was different now. Within less than a minute, he could hear the friction of the air rushing by the window as the craft climbed out above the concrete, steel, and glass forest of Midtown Manhattan. For a moment, the view looked artificial, with all the lights and colors below him. He tried to soak it in, all at once. It was a rare privilege to fly off Trump Tower this way. It might be the last time he would ever see the lights of New York like this. He swallowed. A shiver ran down the middle of his back as he realized it might be the last time anyone sees them for a long time. The flight was amazingly smooth as they crossed the Hudson and headed west, away from the island. He knew they were flying south as well because of the freeways below and the darkness of the sea off to their left. They were at least 7,000 feet high as the craft seemed quieter than when they lifted off. He looked over his shoulder at each person sitting in a two-seat row by themselves, their faces glued to the view out their window. After about half an hour, leaving the towering city far behind them, it was impossible to tell where they were. He thought about getting his pilot's license a few years ago, but quit after a few lessons when he had a nightmare about getting lost above an endless city without a clue where he could possibly land. He felt like that now. It had been a long and unpredictable day with amazing food, and now he was sitting in a government helicopter flying into more unknown. He glanced over to the Marine to see him sitting, motionless, holding on to his cap in his lap with his eyes almost completely closed. He decided against trying to move freely about the cabin, took a deep breath, and tried to relax by looking out the window again. It was a little more than an hour when he felt the helicopter slightly change angles. Whether he had dozed off or not, he couldn't tell, but a brighter awareness swept over him as he stretched out his legs and checked the knot in his tie. He rebuttoned his top button and pulled the knot neatly into his collar and tugged at his shirt cuffs to make sure they showed a little past his jacket. The craft bumped a little with some turbulence, and he felt it bank a little to the left and then to the right. The other members of his ad hoc team also stirred and began to sit up straighter in their seats. The Marine opened his eyes and put his cap back on and made eye contact with James. A small green light near the phone handle, hanging on the bulkhead next to the Marine, flashed, and he snapped it off its cradle. The lights in the cabin turned on, but they were red in color. The Marine pressed a couple of buttons on the phone and began speaking over the intercom in the cabin. "Close your window shade and make sure your seatbelt is fastened. Return your seat to the upright position. Prepare to land," he said firmly into the mouthpiece. He hung up the phone and crossed his arms. James closed his window shade and leaned forward to speak to the Marine. "Why do we have to close our shades?" asked James. "Sir, flash protocol," said the Marine. "What's that? We're not supposed to see where we're landing?" asked James. "A flash can blind you, sir," said the Marine. He took a cold, deep breath and was about to ask more questions over the din of the cabin when he realized the expression on the Marine's face. He could barely exhale when he gripped the armrests of his seat and felt fear for the first real time in his life. Red alert. That's why the lights changed. The helicopter dropped suddenly and banked hard to the right. "Hang on, sir. Expedited landing," said the Marine, also holding on to his armrests. He felt disoriented as he sank deeply into the cushion of his seat, and the craft lurched back and then left and dropped the tail sharply. He felt a hard bump, and the craft rumbled beneath him. Within seconds, the engine throttle began to drop, and the Marine jumped to his feet, grabbing the large red handle on the door and easily yanking it over to the open position. "Please exit the craft and follow the soldier outside. Stand up. Leave nothing. Watch your step. Sorry for the quick landing, but you must exit the craft and get inside as quickly as possible. Thank you for flying with us and not throwing up on my aircraft. Thank you, sir. Thank you, sir. Ma'am. Thank you, sir," said the Marine, quickly shaking hands with each person and helping them to the top of the stairs. The turbine was still roaring above them as they exited and jogged with the soldier to the shuttle waiting for them a few yards away. James waited until the last person was aboard and stepped in as the rotor wash from the helicopter began ramping up again. The driver closed the door to the shuttle, and it began moving away from the pad as the helicopter pulled hard into the air and banked away. "Take a seat, please. We don't have far to go," said the driver, who was also dressed in desert fatigues. "Holy shit! I thought we were going to crash or something," said Hannah. "Flash protocol, whatever that is," said James, still trying to decide if he was in shock. "It means to prepare for a detonation," said the Admiral, looking worried for the first time since James met him. "Oh, hell no. We're too late. We screwed up," shouted Herbert. "There is no way the whole freaking world was waiting on us up there to figure this out. No way. I'm just a blogger. I talk on the radio," cried Hannah. "You? I'm an accountant. What the hell do I know?" said Herbert. "Where the hell are we?" asked James to the soldier driving. "Pentagon, sir. We'll be there in just a minute," said the soldier. The shuttle stopped at the curb near the wide concrete stairs leading up to the Pentagon. The soldier opened the door and stood up. "Go up the stairs and into those doors. Someone will meet you there," said the soldier. "Well, here we go," said James over his shoulder, suddenly realizing he had forgotten his umbrella. The breeze had picked up, and it began to sprinkle as the seven of them climbed the stairs. "Is it just me, or have we just arrived at Ground Zero?" asked Hannah. "Does it really matter?" asked James to answer her. "I would kind of like to actually digest this apple pie," said Herbert, rubbing his stomach to settle his nerves. "I know what you mean. That prime rib is just sitting there. I think my factory is shut down. All the workers got scared and ran away," said James, patting his own. "I have the same urge since lunch," said Peter. "I got this scream caught in my throat," said Hannah, putting her hand on the front of her neck. A uniformed man in light blue opened one of the glass doors of the building and was motioning to them to come toward him. He extended his hand to shake James's. "I'm Major Meade. Which one of you is Rousseau?" asked the major. "I'm James Rousseau," said James. "You all can follow me. We've been waiting for you," said Major Meade. A bright white flash flickered behind them, and the group ducked their heads. "Oh, Jesus," said Herbert. "Lightning. It's been kind of like that off and on all day," said Major Meade. "It sounds weird, but I'm really glad to hear that," said James. The group followed the major, who walked quickly. "This is the place," said the major as he paused at the door. "Another conference room?" asked James. "If you will wait in here for a few minutes, we'll get you with the team," said the major. "We're ready to meet with whoever. Thanks for your help with everything," said James. "Not a worry, James. It'll just be a few minutes. Promise," said the major. "I remember making a comment at a dinner we had after a conference in Palm Spring back in 2006. Maybe it was the wine, but I don't remember it that way. It was at the beginning of the evening, regardless, because we had placed our order and received our drinks, and this conversation began about what was going on in Washington," said Hannah. "Oh, yeah, we were right in the middle of hope and change. That's what turned me to the dark side. I mean, that's when I became a bank auditor. It was like heaven for regulators," said Herbert. "What were you doing in Palm Springs? That isn't even close to New York," asked James. "I was attending this conference to network into the emerging world of internet radio. It's like bloggers with voice and video. It's huge now, but back then there were not many venues for it. Anyway, a comment was made about whether anyone thought Hillary would run again for president after getting spanked by Obama. I couldn't help myself. I said that Hillary would facilitate another terrorist attack if she thought it would improve her chances of getting elected," said Hannah. "I'll bet that won friends and influence people," said Peter. "My boyfriend, at the time, told me later I shouldn't have done it. I vaguely recall him saying something about sugar and flies, but I'm kind of this carpe diem bitch sometimes. I just gotta do it. Like Field of Dreams, you know?" asked Hannah. "You mean, if you build it, he will come?" asked James. "No, no. Remember the scene when Costner and Madigan," she played Annie, "were at the PTA meeting, and Beulah, played by Lee Garlington, was talking about removing the books from the school library. Anyway, Annie said, 'They're talking about banning books again, really subversive books like Diary of Anne Frank and Wizard of Oz.' And then finally she quips back to Beulah, 'At least he's not a book burner, you Nazi cow.' Well, at that moment, that line by Madigan is what pointed me in this direction and fired me out of the barrel to become the voice I am today," said Hannah. "I look back at the events that brought me here. I can't see a line at all. It feels more like a train wreck," said James. "I digressed. I really meant what I said back in 06, but I didn't know how right I was until now. This syndicate is willing to let hundreds of thousands of Americans die in order to stop Trump from succeeding. I'm sorry, but that blows me away," said Hannah.
"I don't think you're wrong," said Yuri.
"What makes you say that?" asked Hannah.
"I thought Obama was insane for dismantling the TARS project. I was mad that we lost the contract, and my job, of course. But the move was so deliberate, so calculated, that I was also blown away nobody else saw it or said anything about it," said Yuri.
"I still think it was all fake," said Peter.
"I assure you, it was real, my friend. One day we could see for 1,000 miles. And the next day we were lucky to see 10 miles, said Yuri. "That's not what I meant. I meant all this stuff, turns out, was just a decoy. It was all a distraction. So we would never see what they were really planning," said Peter.
The door of the room suddenly opened and a man wearing a black jumpsuit walked in.
"I have another take on that," said the man.
"You were listening to us?" spat Hannah, ready for a fight. "You're the reason we're here. My name is Thomas Larson. There is a straighter line than you think through these events, but we don't have time to talk about that right now. I need your report."
"You're Jack's teacher," said James, as a matter of fact.
"Was. She's graduating Monday," said Mr. Larson.
"That's right. I'm supposed to be..." "Oh, what the hell," said James, shaking his head and sitting down at the table in the room.
"You're James Rousseau. Glad to meet you. One hell of a sister you have.
You're this team's leader?" asked Mr. Larson, shaking his head. more like a facilitator. These people were chosen for concerns they shared with the White House. I'm just a lobbyist, said James.
I think I speak for everyone when I say we suck at meetings. James did a good job of keeping us focused. We'd still be at Trump Tower if it wasn't for him, said Hannah, putting her hand on his shoulder.
Then I need you to tell me where the device will be deployed, said Mr. Larson.
Nashville, Tennessee, said James, looking at the table while Hannah gently rubbed his shoulder with her palm.
Have you told anyone else this information? Asked Mr. Larson.
No, said James.
Wait, what did you say on the phone when you called that guy? Asked Peter.
He said that we had reached a decision. That's what I remember, said Herbert.
Yeah, that's right. I have a memory for words. That's what he said.
You're the first to hear the word Nashville, said Hannah.
I think that's right. I said that we were ready. We've reached our decision, confirmed James.
Very well. I just wanted you to know that we could not have done this without you. The president wasn't sure about the intel. I wasn't either. Our most intelligent analysts selected each of you based upon your submissions. The level of compromise in the agency made that impossible, said Mr. Larson.
Are we too late? Asked Hannah.
That's not how it works, said Mr. Larson.
You're Special Agent Larson, said the Admiral.
Yes, Admiral, said Mr. Larson.
You oppose the 9/11 response, said the Admiral.
I still do. The Defense Authorization Act was crafted during the Clinton administration, but the syndicate decided to let Bush build the temple, said Mr. Larson.
I disagreed with your analysis, said the Admiral.
Have you ever wondered why America doesn't show up in the Bible, Admiral? The richest, most powerful nation the world has ever known, and there is not a syllable anywhere to be found about America. Tell me why, Admiral, demanded Mr. Larson.
I couldn't tell you, said the Admiral dismissively.
Because we didn't last long enough, said Mr. Larson. The room was silent in the fog of tension that Mr. Larson had created. His eyes locked on to the Admiral uncomfortably until the Admiral looked away.
I never thought about it that way, said the Admiral quietly.
You weren't alone, said Mr. Larson as he turned and took a step for the door.
What do you mean, the temple? Asked Hannah, making Mr. Larson pause and face her, smiling slightly.
David assassinated Bathsheba's husband to seduce her. He killed tens of thousands in genocidal wars. God remarked that he had too much blood on his hands, so he assigned his son Solomon to build the temple. Bush had the clean hands they needed to ask us to give up our rights without a fight, said Mr. Larson.
But if the Defense Authorization Act was fashioned years ahead of time, what was 9/11? Asked James.
Well, they had the perfect solution. All they needed was a problem big enough to pull it off, said Hannah.
So what was Bush supposed to do after they bombed the hell out of New York? Asked Peter.
They? Asked Mr. Larson, tilting his head.
The same people who are getting ready to flatten Nashville, said the Admiral.
Right you are, Admiral. We don't have much time. Let's go, said Mr. Larson.